Whether you're a world-class athlete or a podcaster like me, we all understand the importance of mental and physical well-being and proper recovery for top-notch performance. That's why I'm excited that Unified Healing is sponsoring podcasts on the Blue Wire Network. Unified Healing is a new and super innovative global network of wellness centers powered by Energy Enhancement System, or EE System. If you haven't heard of the EE System yet, then you'll want to listen up. This technology promotes wellness, deep relaxation, purification, and rejuvenation. Wherever you are across the globe, access to a center is easy and affordable. Interested in experiencing the EE System technology for yourself? Go to unifiedhealing.com/bluewire to learn more and find a center near you. That's Unified, U-N-I-F-Y-D, healing.com/bluewire. No material or testimonials on the Unified Healing website are intended to be viewed as medical advice or a substitute for professional medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment. Always seek the advice of your physician or other qualified healthcare provider with any questions you may have regarding a medical condition or treatment and before undertaking a new healthcare regimen, including EE System.
The Notorious OTB on the Sports Gambling Podcast Network is presented by WynnBET. It is now live in Arizona, Colorado, Indiana, Louisiana, Michigan, New Jersey, New York, Tennessee, and Virginia. From boosted same-game parlays to live in-game odds, WynnBET has what you need to win. Sign up today, bet $100, and get a $100 free bet at sportsgamblingpodcast.com/WYNNBET. That's sportsgamblingpodcast.com/WYNNBET. We're also brought to you by the SGPN store and their big Cyber Monday sale. 20% off everything in the store for one day only. It's this Monday using this code CYBER at store.sportsgamblingpodcast.com. Welcome, everybody, to the Notorious OTB, brought to you by the Sports Gambling Podcast Network. And as always,
it's all good, baby. It was all a dream.
We used to read Blood Horse Magazine. I'm your host, Chase Sessoms, Wolf of Oakland, fresh off of his, we'll call it, extended turkey nap hibernation during the Thanksgiving holiday. And joining me, guess who finally decided to show up. What's up, Mr. Johnny Come Lately? Matthew DeSantis at Failed to Menace. He failed to menace, but succeeded in stealing our hearts and then ran away with them and didn't come back to the show for a little bit. Matthew, what's going on, man?
I know. It's been like a month since I talked to you, and it's felt just like eons. And so it's great to be back on the show. I'm thrilled to be here. And it's always a blast talking to you. And obviously a great time of year as well to, recalibrate a little bit. I'm thinking about horse racing and handicapping. You know, we got through obviously some of the big races this year, and the downtime is always good to sit back and reflect and think about what we can improve and give advice to folks about how they can improve as handicappers as well.
Because when downtime comes, it's not like there's an abundance of it. It's not like you have like a 6 month off season or anything. Like your downtime is like a week and a half kind of thing. So like for me, I've got Oakland getting ready to kick off, and it used to be, I'd have to wait until Oakland opened up in January until I felt like real like consequential racing was happening again. But I mean, there's really just no break. Like you're going to get right into it with Derby preps and everything. Once Oakland starts racing, then Gulfstream fires up and Santa Anita gets going, and it's, you know, then we're really back into the grind again. I had an insane thing happen to me today, Matthew. I guess let me rephrase. I had an insane thing happen to my wife. We drive back from, her family's place in like the Memphis area. And, I get home and I'm hanging out watching football. The wife comes in and she's like, "So in our yard next to the street is what looks like a Kevlar bulletproof vest."
Oh, wow.
Now for her, that's a shock. But for me, you know,
many men wish death upon me. Blood in my dog and I can't see.
You know, for me, That's normal, you know. It comes with the business, you know. Sometimes it's a Kevlar vest. Sometimes it's like a pile of deceased elite hitmen, you know. Like
when you live that life,
It's the cost of business of being a kingpin, basically. Do you have anything just crazy happen over Thanksgiving with your because you spent a lot of time with your dad. I know you saw your mom a little bit.
I did. Nothing too crazy happening in the bustling metropoli of Gum Spring, Virginia, and Travelers Rest, South Carolina.
Travelers Rest.
Yeah, both of those towns are as big as they sound. And it is nothing too crazy, but always good times to see everyone. And the other nice part is both my parents are huge horse racing fans. So it's a nice opportunity to chat with them about that. And my mom's handicapping skills usually go as far as betting on the gray horse. And my dad's is usually fading whoever Andy Serling is picking, just purely out of spite. And so that is, that tells you everything you need to know about where I came from as a handicapper. So.
Yeah, no, I love it. I love that quite a bit. For one, betting on the gray horse is a plus 1000 ROI, move. And then when it comes to betting against Andy Serling, I don't always frown at that. I'm surprised I haven't been blocked by Andy Serling yet on Twitter. That feels like a rite of passage. I feel like I've towed that line. Like, there was one time last summer where he was like, well, I was gonna put the scratches in, but there's something wrong with Twitter not letting me upload pictures. I replied, you could like type them. And my buddy Ben Wilkie, Sham Pals on Discord, was like, I'm really surprised you weren't just blocked. Like, I could see him getting angry as he read that.
Horse racing Twitter is always a very fickle creature, and people's egos are very easily bruised in that space. And I think folks like you and I have a pretty thick skin. I don't think I've ever blocked anyone. I don't think so. That's not like a spam account, basically. I've definitely muted people or just decided not to follow people, but I've never blocked somebody. If they show up in my timeline a lot, then I'm like, well, maybe clearly people who I respect seem to think that what they're saying is valid. And so maybe I should take a second look at this person.
That is a very open-minded way to approach it. Like, for me, like, if I'm going to unfollow you, I don't block people. I don't think I've been blocked by many people. I might have been blocked by way more than I assume. But, for me, like, if you just get, like, hyper-political, like, if everything is, like, a political tweet, it's like, boop, done with that. That is not what I am here for in the slightest. You know what we are here for, though? We're gonna do something different today. We're not handicapping a sequence. We're more talking handicapping in general. And I've been thinking about how to phrase this because, you know, we're getting towards the holidays. So I'm going to set this up and I'm going to tie it all back together when we get done with our first break, which is we're going to show you our Dickensian aspect. Are your wheels starting? Find out what that means when we come back to the Notorious OTB, brought to you by the Sports Gambling Podcast Network. Ready to win money and boost your odds? WynnBET is now live in Arizona, Colorado, Indiana, Louisiana, Michigan, New Jersey, New York, Tennessee, and Virginia. We're bringing the excitement of Wynn Las Vegas to online sports betting and casino play. Exclusive rewards are right at your fingertips with Wynn Rewards on WynnBET. Looking to get involved in the same game parlay? WynnBET is your home with the WynnBET Build Your Own Bet, letting you customize the bet you want to make. Great promos, odds, and payouts are happening right now at WynnBET. WynnBET has what you need to win. Ready to play? Sign up today. Receive a special offer. Bet $100, win $100. There's so much to choose from, and all you have to do is head over to sportsgamblingpodcast.com/WynnBET so they know that we sent you. That's sportsgamblingpodcast.com/WynnBET to claim your free bet today. Offer subject to change. Terms and conditions at WynnBET.com. Must be 21 or older and present in the state where playthrough WynnBET is available. If you're someone you know has a gambling problem, call 1-800-522-4700. Also, it's Cyber Monday still, kind of, for the next couple hours. 20% off of everything in the merch store using their promo code CYBER. Store at sportsgamblingpodcast.com. It's one day only. That's where you use the code CYBER. Hell, man, there's all sorts of good stuff in there. You need things for Christmas. Bet you got, like, a sister who's real uptight and really won't like something like a onesie proclaiming her kid to be a degen. That's what you should buy. That's what you should get. Well, you can get it at the store, sports.sportsgamblingpodcast.com, using the code CYBER, 20% off the entire merch store. Welcome back to the Notorious OTB, brought to you by the Sports. Let's try that again. Welcome to the Notorious OTB, brought to you by the Sports Gambling Podcast Network. So, I left you with a little cliffhanger where I promised to show you our Dickensian aspect. You're probably wondering what that actually means. If you get, follow me, because this gets kind of twisted to it. If we remember the Charles Dickens novel, A Christmas Carol, one Ebenezer Scrooge is visited by Jacob Marley. He's told he's going to be visited by three ghosts, one of them being the ghost of Christmas past, who shows him a Christmas from his past. So here's how it ties all together. Get ready. Okay, here we go. What Matthew and I are going to be talking about right now is, if a Jacob Marley showed up, we were visited by a ghost of Christmas past, and we saw ourselves as younger handicappers, what would we tell ourselves? Like, what's the stuff that we wish that we knew whenever we were first starting that would have just saved us time, anguish, and money? That's something that, if you're a newer handicapper, if these are things that you aren't doing, you can start folding in, and you could just, like, level up. Like, it's like in Super Mario, where you don't, like, wait to, you know, go to the next level. You find the secret warp, and you just go automatically to the next world, you know? You just skip past it. So that's kind of the idea here. Matthew, are you following me? Are you with me so far?
I'm following you. Christmas past, Christmas present, Christmas future. Where I'm ready for all of them. But it's funny because I got introduced to horse racing at a very young age. I mean, I was probably 10, 11 years old when my dad first took me to the track. And so it's interesting when we were talking about this before we recorded, and you were kind of telling me the idea. And I came back to when I was 11, 12 years old, but going back to more when I was like 16, 17, 18, like I was really starting to get a little bit more knowledgeable about things and the advice that I would give myself then. Because my advice that I would give myself at 11 was don't do $2 show bets. But that was a whole another phase of my life that we've gotten past.
Yeah. Also, stay away from waitresses. And, there's a whole lot of things you can tell. Just drill into yourself at the age of 11. That sounded weird. That sounded like a self-loving Marty McFly sort of situation there. But, you know, stuff that you could just, you know, really get in, get a good base in. And see, for me, it's a little bit different. Like, the way I started handicapping, and this is within the last decade. I haven't been doing it more than 10 years. My mom, for her 60th birthday, decided she wanted to go to Oaklawn. And I knew, me being like, and I was the guy who was always making crazy spreadsheets, you know, as my living for work, but also for fantasy sports, for everything. And I was like, oh, I fucking got horse racing. I'll just figure out what to dump into a spreadsheet and be able to do that, you know. And so the other thing is, when you don't have friends, family who do this, and you're kind of starting on your own, the way you figure things out is through books. And there's like, you don't have other people to just kind of illuminate the things that now we think of as absolutely simple, but it turned, you know, would have been like a groundbreaking thing for us. So Matthew and I each have three little tips for how we're going to, you know, things that you newer handicappers can listen to and say, hey, I should learn more about this. And hopefully, I'm going to say probably, you'll see the upside once you do, because they're all, you know, nothing crazy high tech. It's just kind of just simple little things that we do every time. So without further ado, our three tips, three from each of us, six total tips. Matthew, what's your number three?
Yeah, my number three is something that, again, going back to thinking about when I first started handicapping and really seriously handicapping, educating yourself about the different tracks. And I think that's something which is particularly helpful the deeper you get into handicapping. It's one thing if you're capping the Breeders' Cup and the Triple Crown, maybe, and things like that, where everybody's running at big time tracks, you know, Santa Anita and Del Mar and Churchill and Keeneland and Saratoga, et cetera. Okay, you know, everybody knows those are the primary tracks, but knowing a little bit more about Sam Houston, knowing a little bit more about Laurel, knowing a little bit more about Charlestown, knowing about Canterbury, knowing about Indiana Grand, knowing about Tampa Bay Downs, knowing about Lone Star, like just knowing the track hierarchy, first of all, of where are your primary tracks, where are your top tier tracks, where are your kind of secondary, you know, middle class tracks, if you will, and where's your kind of working class tracks, you know, at the kind of, I don't want to say the bottom rung, but where's the, you know, $2,000 claiming races taking place. And knowing that, and it helps you identify horses that are either stepping up sometimes or stepping down in terms of the class of the track that they're running at. They could be running the same level race, but if they're running from, you know, if they're going from Churchill to Laurel, well, that's a downgrade. And so presumably they've been running against much, much better competition. And so just knowing that, similarly, finding a horse that's been running again, you know, lights out against lower level competition and stepping up is something that is, you know, sometimes can be a red flag. But I think that's something where a lot of us are so regional. You know, we get with you with Oak Lawn, myself growing up in Pennsylvania with Penn National and Parks. That was something which, you know, I had a very mid-Atlantic view of horse racing in a lot of ways for a lot of years. And so just knowing about Remington Park and knowing about Prairie Meadows and then knowing the track biases that take place in each of those instances, how the turf courses play in those tracks. And one of the things that I really is also very important is knowing where the starting gate is for the different distances.
Right.
So knowing
track configurations. Yeah, it's a big thing.
It's huge. Knowing how long the run-in is before they go into the first turn, you know, whether it's a turf sprint or whether it's a two-turn, you know, dirt mile or something like that. Those are really, really important factors to take into account. And it's something which, like I said, a lot of us start local. And so just expanding your base and knowing more about that, that's something I didn't really grasp for maybe the first, you know, 4 or 5 years that I was really handicapping. I was just so focused on my little world of the Mid-Atlantic that I was ignoring shippers that were coming in and just not really getting a great grasp of that all the time.
I think that's actually a pretty timely piece of advice because of especially just thinking about where we are in the year. You have a bunch of horses from you know, in Kentucky that are about to start running at Turfway. If they're not running in Kentucky, they're going to ship down to Fairgrounds. They're going to ship to Oak Lawn. They're going to ship to Florida. They're going to ship to all these different places. I mean, and even expanding upon what you have is learning your trainers and learning how they perform at the different levels of tracks. Like, is it like Steven Aspison who just cleans up at every race at Lone Star? Is it like Carl Broberg who might suck, you know, might not do as well at the bigger tracks, but if you catch him at a track in Louisiana on a weeknight, he's probably going to win every single thing that's not nailed down with CJ Attempted Murder McMahon up in the irons. I love Money Stacks. I love Money Stacks. Sometimes you just got to pull a trigger. I mean,
many men wish death upon me, blood in my.
Yeah, I mean, you just got to handle your business, you know. World, so me and CJ pack two heaters.
No, you do. And it's a great point about the, you know, Asmussen. And that's another one where sometimes Asmussen can bring in a horse to Sam Houston or something like that that just has not been running well anywhere. And all of a sudden that horse just lights out at Sam Houston because it's, you know, the horse has been running at Churchill. The horse has been running at Saratoga. And all of a sudden now he's going down to Sam Houston. And I mean, that's always, I think, eye-popping, and this gets in other aspects of handicapping, but when you look at, like, the workout tab, and you see, like, these Aspen horses that are running, like, 48-second four furlongs, and the horses they're running against are running, like, 53-second four furlongs, and you're like, okay, this is going to be over quick, and it usually is.
Yeah, and I mean, it's not just one thing where it's like, hey, let me learn when to fade horses because they're shipping into smaller tracks. It's like, but it's also, hey, let me upgrade this specific horse, even though it's been racing in a smaller track, because this is what I understand about the track circuit. There's one horse I can think of specifically that I think actually won the Met Mile for the aforementioned Ass Man, which is B Jersey. B Jersey either came from Lone Star or Sam Houston. I was like, this horse doesn't have a chance in the Met Mile because it's a Sam Houston shipper.
Yeah.
Wrong. They still have chances. So I'm going to go ahead. I'm going to give you my tip three. You know, Matthew did a really good job of putting together really well thought out tips that are in depth and everything. I'm going to hit you with the low hanging fruit here. Handicap without the morning lines. It's a big deal. Either buy the past performances early enough that they don't have the morning lines in it, learn how to block them out. Like now that I've been doing it long enough, I have like morning line, like blindness where I just don't even notice when it's up there. If you use DRF, you use Formulator, you can just turn your morning lines off. Now, why is that important? It's not just because it clutters it up. It gives you more things to think about. when you're getting started, I feel like people tend to view the morning lines almost as the gospel. Like they see a 4-5 on the morning line. It's like, oh, well, this horse is unbeatable. Let's just go ahead and move on. The morning line has it. Here's the deal about morning line makers. There are only a couple who are really good at it. Like David Aragona. David Aragona in New York makes a great morning line.
Yep.
There are places where there are really bad morning lines. And it really kind of throws off the pools. Being able to handicap, get an unbiased opinion without using the morning lines helps you find this sort of value. Know like when's a good time to be against the public who's maybe trusting this. I mean, it's at its core is handicapping. It's finding the value in a horse that you think is undervalued.
Absolutely. And it's funny. I was going to mention David because one of the other tips you could just give is like identify people who are really good at setting morning lines and sometimes pay attention to those. If you're struggling and, you know, if you're handicapping the New York circuit, sometimes I like looking at David's morning lines to go, oh, well, that's how he sees this hierarchy going. You know, there was just a race recently where he had three Triad Brown entries at 5-2, 5-2, and 3-1. And it was like, okay, so he doesn't really see any difference between these three horses. So, you know, and that's where you can start to dig in and maybe find value. And so, yeah, I think you're absolutely right. And that's another one where you just pay attention to what their morning line is and then pay attention to how the horses go off. And that'll tell you everything you need to know about which tracks in particular to ignore for the morning line. You know, and obviously, you know, there's a bunch of mitigating circumstances that can go into that. But and by the way, let me be clear, setting the morning line is something I never want to have to do for my job,
right?
Because it is a thankless job.
Absolutely.
In a lot of ways. But I think you're absolutely right that you can identify huge value sometimes if you just look at it with a fresh set of eyes, essentially, and you're not biased by somebody saying, well, that's a 12-1 horse. And you go, well, maybe I'll skip over looking at that more in depth. You do it blind. You can really, like I said, identify some horses that end up being huge values.
And I mean, you can also, I mean, if you want to, if I'm going to make this like a 3A, I guess, 3 with a bullet, which is try as an exercise, handicap without the morning lines, go through each horse and then pick out what you think they're going to close at. Like when the gates pop, where you think the odds are. And it'll kind of, you'll learn to go back and look and say you have maybe had a horse that you were like, oh, this is going to close at 20-1. And it goes off, you know, 3-1, 4-1. You can then go back and say, why was I so wrong? Why did this horse take so much money? And it makes you a little bit more savvy looking forward into your days as to, yes, I found this 30-1 shot. I handicapped it without the morning lines. I really liked it, but it ended up going off damn near the favorite. So What was it? What was it that tipped off John Q betting public, you know, that this was happening?
Great. All right.
Number two. What do you got?
Yeah, so number two is more of a tip, but something that I have picked up and is maybe one of my favorite angles now, which is really paying attention to equipment changes in lower level races. This is something that I probably didn't pay as much attention to as I should have early on, and it's because equipment changes can be a little hit or miss sometimes, and I think at certain levels of racing, it can be very overstated. I think when you're looking at stakes races, when you're looking at high-level allowance races, blinkers going on, it can be a little overstated. The Lasix thing is just so all over the place. I think it's hard to know how individual horses react to that all the time. And especially with all the different state variations to it, it's just, you know, again, it can be difficult to have a precise handicapping perspective on it, but particularly blinkers. That is one of my favorite angles, is just going to a maiden claiming race and looking at who's getting blinkers on, because a lot of times maiden claiming races are sprints, because these horses haven't won yet. And so they're not stretching the horse out. I mean, I can't think of the last time there was a 2-turn turf maiden claiming race. I mean, you just don't see those types of races very often.
Right.
And so it's a sprint, and therefore it's about speed and who's going to get to the lead first. And these horses are not world beaters. And so you get a horse to the lead early, that horse feels brave, and suddenly a horse that has shown nothing to this point is the winner. And you go, how's this horse that's finished no better than 8th any time in their career suddenly taken down the win? And so that's one I just use a lot. And again, it's about when you use some of these angles. It's not just, oh, equipment change across the board, I'm going to play that blinkers on or blinkers off angle. It's knowing what type of races blinkers on is going to have the biggest impact on. Low level claiming races, maiden claiming races. That's where I'm looking to play that angle. Not really looking at it anywhere else. And, you know, a lot of times, too, these trainers are trying to throw the kitchen sink at these horses to get them into the winner circle for the first time in a maiden claimer. So, you know, they kind of are trying a lot of stuff. And like I said, you can a lot of times find big prices in those spots. And so that's an angle that I wish I had discovered a little bit earlier, because I've had a lot of success with.
I think especially with the lower level races,
yeah,
seeing those sort of moves where they're putting Lasix on, they're putting blinkers on, they're, you know, trying weight breaks, they're trying all sorts of stuff.
Yeah,
I mean, with those, especially like say it's like a $5,000 claimer, well, I feel like a lot of the trainers probably have, unless it's like their one horse, they have tons of other horses that are probably running at other different levels, more important levels. It shows that they're actually like invested, right, in trying, yeah, to get the horse to win, that they actually care about it. But I will tell you, I mean, when you, no matter what the race is, if you throw in blinkers, you throw in Lasix, you geld the horse, you give it a weight break, yeah, I'm a simp for it.
Little pig boy.
Can I get the definition?
Little pig boy. He's that pathetic, dirty bitch baby mistress gets to stand on.
I'm a dirty little pig boy. Dirty little pig boy for those moves. One thing I think, and I'll add to yours, is understand what these equipment changes are intended to do.
Yes.
Like, what is the point of adding blinkers? What is the point of taking off blinkers? Especially like for maiden races, understanding that they're putting blinkers on to usually get a couple extra lengths of gate speed out. You know, that's kind of the intended, you know, get them moving a little bit faster earlier is great, especially maiden races where you have races that are often won wire to wire. Like putting blinks on those horses, that's worth noting. Or it's worth noting because you have a horse that's never shown a ton of early speed. Well, now it's going to show early speed. So what is it going to do to the overall, you know, pace scenario of the race? Like, right, they're understanding, not only understanding, you know, when to play those angles, but why they do those things to, I mean, essentially create an angle for yourself of, I like it whenever they add blinkers to horses who have done this. Congratulations. You came up with your first personal angle, you know?
Yeah, absolutely. And to be very specific about the types of horses I like to see blinkers get put on, a lot of times it's a horse that breaks poorly or doesn't show speed and is like 10 lengths back at second call, but then finishes like 10 lengths back. Right. And it shows that the horse doesn't mind running. It just shows that the horse got off to a crappy start in a lot of instances. Yeah. Now, a horse that is 8 lengths back at second call and finishes 25 lengths back, I worry a little bit more. I go, I don't know if blinkers is necessarily going to do the trick there, because that's a horse that may not always love to run, but a horse that kind of runs evenly the whole way around. And you go, listen, if this horse just got a little bit more speed out of the gate, this horse could get up there and seem to be running around the same pace as everybody else once they got going. And so you put the blinkers on, that makes a huge difference. So, but blinkers also have different impacts on different types of horses. And sometimes trainers will tell you that, you know, horses will finish better with certain, you know, types of blinkers as well. So, it's always good to know kind of why these equipment changes matter, why a horse is gelded, why, is this horse going to be easier to handle now in the starting gate and not going to get as worked up and lathered up before going out, yeah, to the gate, you know? So understanding the purpose behind those equipment changes is so critical.
Yeah. And I actually love those horses that start off maybe like 5 links back, then finish like 30 links back. And then, you know, they throw blinkers on it. Cause to me, it's a horse that, had needed the lead. Otherwise,
it
would quit. And, finding those horses that I think were need the lead types, then quit. I mean, mistress should be angry at me.
Little pig boy comes from the dirt. He's a weaselly little mud grub who needs to be stood on. Little pig boy.
Gold, absolute gold. All right, so my number two is it's kind of I will admit this can be a very nebulous subject. However, I think just getting yourself as acclimated to the basics of it and learning more about it as you go is something that's huge. So when I started handicapping, like I said, I was a grown man in my office at work who's like, I'm going to solve the world through a spreadsheet, you know, pulling together speed figures, things like this, being very, very like figure and numerical based. You read books to learn how to handicap. You pick up Andy Byer's book. What is Andy Byer's book is going to tell you? I mean, as the father of the Byer speed figure, it is going to be how to handicap with, you know, these figures where the figure is the, you know, be all end all, the highest, you know, it's the fastest, quote, air quotes, fastest horse. And therefore it's going to run the fastest race and win. Stop thinking like that. Don't I look at that? And then I look at where I am now, 95% of how I handicap a race almost goes to pace. It's all about the pace setup. It's the trip that they're going, that the horses are going to get within the context of the entire race of everybody that they're running with. Who's it going to benefit? Who's it going to hurt? Because it happens in every race that there's a pace that's going to benefit some group of horses, and it's going to extremely hurt other groups of horses. And so you can find that there are times where I've even seen a horse that's maybe say 20 points slower than other horses, but the pace setup just works out perfectly. And it's the big step, because when you're handicapping by figures alone, get ready to hit, to eat a lot of chalk. You'll be right on horses right. That you should be right about a lot of the time. You know, you're going to be wrong on the horses that, you know, you never would have caught by figures a lot of the time also. And the thing is, that's where a lot of the value tends to come from. So you learning to look at something in terms of this whole race is an organism. It's like an amoeba that's just moving around, but it's all together one organism. When you're looking at just the figures and handicapping from that standpoint, what you're doing is you're looking at the race horse by horse by horse and saying, if you separate out this horse and it runs like it wants to, this is what it will do. But you can't look at it like that. For one, these animals are pack animals. Like there's a hierarchy to how they run together and everything. And there's like personalities and stuff. So, you know, just because a horse had a hundred Byer doesn't mean it's a true alpha and it's out there, you know, going to be out there running every single pack. It's not how it works. And it's something that I remember distinctly thinking, you know, seeing one time like, oh, hey, it seems like everyone went really fast there. And then the closer was able to pick it up. Light bulb. Mm-hmm. There it is. Well, there, we turned the light bulb on for you. Do more research into it. Buy books on pace. There are things that are extremely simple and there are things that you need a fucking piece of scratch paper and a TI-83 for. It's just all about what you're more comfortable with.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think it was nice. This actually blends with some of the other advice I was talking about earlier with getting to know your tracks too. Because one of the big things that I would say is getting to know how jockey colonies approach pace in different spaces.
I feel we're about to talk about New York.
Yeah, we're going to talk about New York turf races. Which, I mean, you can look at the PPs all day, and they're going to run 25-50 for the opening quarter and a half. Like, they just are. No matter, it doesn't matter how fast the horse is. Yeah. I rattle straight out that fraction. Front. And I mean, it's just, it kills me. So
Kendrick Carmouche will be out there with him.
Exactly. So you just, you know, sometimes you can sit there and look at what a pace scenario should be, but then also knowing jockeys well enough. And that's the other thing, is knowing jockeys who are aggressive and seeing a jockey who's aggressive on a horse that likes to go to the lead. And you go, okay, that's a nice setup right there. Mm-hmm. Versus a jockey who might be a little bit more timid with a horse that likes to go to the lead. And you go, there's another speed horse in here. Is this horse really going to get sent as hard as he needs to? You know, those are the angles that you just always need to consider as well. And then I think it also speaks to like the track hierarchy as well. Like, okay, this is a horse that always gets to the lead at Evangeline Downs. Yep. Now this horse is running at Keeneland. Maybe I'm less optimistic about this horse getting to the lead against more elite competition.
Right.
And I mean, that's where pace figures get into, you know, play, obviously, and early pace versus late pace, et cetera. But, you know, I pace is huge. I mean, I much like you, probably the first thing I do, honestly, when I look at a PP for a race is I very quickly scroll down and see how many ones do I see across the running lines for how many different horses. And that tells me a lot about how I'm going to approach that particular race.
See, and that's what I'll do is I'll, as I'm making my own personal pace projections, you've seen my bootleg ass, don't sue me time form pace projections. What I'll do is I'm like you, I will scroll through and the first thing I do is find the horses that I think will be out there on the lead and make sure that I take the, you know, the image and put it out to the front in front of all the horses there, and then go back through and start looking at where horses like to run off of the pace, like how many lengths and stuff. And then, I mean, hell, we can even fold it into your tip about equipment and say, okay, now I'm looking at this horse who's had an equipment change and added blinkers. Normally it likes to run five lengths back. Well, with these blinkers, is it going to run 2 to 3 lengths back? Is it going to be a little bit closer and add more pressure to it? Just understanding pace, understanding how they all work together, and understanding that pace is always about pressure. It's going to put pressure on, it's going to put pressure on some horses. It's going to be easier on other horses. If you want to talk about pace pressure, there's a book that's called Extreme Pace Handicapping that teaches you a pace pressure gauge based on like the Kieran speed points, which is, you see like the EP1 through 8 or, you know, E8, S1 through whatever. It's a process of using like the run styles along with those Kieran speed points to come up with a pace pressure gauge to tell you how hot it's going to be. It's worth checking out because it's, before I got super into pace and understanding the fractions, that was like my first step into it. And it was so basic and so easy to understand. And you get the book and you're like, why did I pay for this book when I only needed to pay for the first like 20 pages? Because it's seriously just as simple as I described there. So yeah, check that out. And then whenever you get into it, you can start getting to, I think that whatever the book is from like the DRF, that's like really like high depth, like calculating your turn times and things like that for handicapping. So Matthew, what is your number one? If you were to go back in time, little Matthew DeSantis is slaving over next to his oil lamp, writing with his quill and Ebenezer Serling's fucking, you know, handicap sweatshop. Like, he hadn't even bought the Matthew DeSantis hat yet. Like, he's not even really Matthew DeSantis. What do you tell that young man? What is the number one thing you tell that young man?
It's funny. Number one thing is something I still work on every single day, which is trainer intent. What do trainers intend from a horse? Because you and I can do all the handicapping in the world. But if a trainer is using this race as a workout, basically, and pointing towards something else, then all the handicapping kind of goes to crap because the horse isn't ready to run, or the horse isn't kind of, this is not what the horse is pointing toward.
Right.
I think something which I've become much more conscientious of over the last several years is knowing what races horses are pointing towards for the year. Mm-hmm. Now, sometimes that's easier to figure out, obviously, with bigger named horses and big time trainers. From the very beginning of the year, what is this horse's goal? Is it the Breeders' Cup? Is it something, you know, or is it just a big stakes race at a local track, you know, something like that? What are they pointing this horse toward? Trainer intent in maiden races, you know, Shug McGahey, infamously, you know, let Shug McGahey horses run one or two times before you start putting money on them in a maiden race. They run into shape. Right. Other trainers, they are ready out of the box. I mean, they are ready out of the gate to go and win that first race. Yeah.
Absolutely.
And just understanding trainer intent. And also, and this goes to the tracks we talked about earlier. What tracks do certain trainers take their best horses to? And knowing where do trainers want to pick up that maiden special weight win in some cases, or where are trainers going to prioritize winning that training title in some instances?
Yeah.
You know, it was no mistake that Brad Cox cleaned up at Keeneland in the fall. That was very clearly where he wanted to do well. He's a Midwestern trainer. And so, you know, those things matter. And it can be tough. It can be a lot of reading in between the tea leaves a little bit. It can be paying attention to workout tabs. It can be paying attention to trainer interviews in some cases. Like, it takes a lot of things to pull together. It's not this, like, number that you can look at or this, you know, specific angle. It's just, it's nebulous. But it is something that just has so much impact because after a race is run, you know, you hear the trainer give an interview and you go, oh, they never intended for this horse to win this race. So then you go, oh, well, I'm an idiot for trying to bet on this horse. So I think those are just things to trainer intent, something, like I said, I think all of us are always trying to get better at, and just understanding that it's not going to be easy to always track down, particularly at the lower level races. But like I said, in maiden races, I think, you know, trainer stats can be extremely helpful and things like that. And then the upper levels, it's just about paying attention to trends and interviews and understanding where horses are pointed towards during different times of the year.
You know, a super obvious way to get onto these, you know, the trainer, you know, trainer intents with your more upscale horses. Let's pick, I'm going to say a random name. Let's say Jack Christopher has been running in grade one, grade two, grade three races. Now he's dropped to a $100,000 optional claimer. There's no claiming tag. Well, that is an obvious, you know, tighten the screws sort of race for something that's coming down the line, you know, for a graded stakes down the line where, you know, the horse runs its best because maybe it just needs to get a race out of its system. Maybe they're working on something new. But it makes some dicey propositions. I mean, those horses do not always, you'll wonder like why this world beater didn't run a lick against all these other horses. Like Matthew just said, they were never, you know, intending the, you know, to actually get out and win here. And, you know, also, like you said, where do people want to win things? That's important. That is a very important point that Matthew brings up.
I was just going to say, there's a horse to that point about where they win things. There was a horse that debuted at Parks this past Pennsylvania Derby Day, and Tuskegee Airmen, mm-hmm. and won the.
My grandfather was in the Tuskegee experiments.
There you go.
But not really. That's sorry. That's such like a random non sequitur Dave Chappelle quote. Me being a white person would sound like he administered. We were nowhere near those. I'm just going to put that out there.
But this is a horse that it's interesting that the day of the race, I think, was like 4-1, and it had never run before, and the trainer stats weren't overwhelming. But I talked to someone on the track, and they said, "Oh, that horse was supposed to debut at Saratoga." And I promptly went to the betting window and I put everything I had on Tuskegee mm-hmm. Airmen because mm-hmm. if they had, and the only reason he didn't debut at Saratoga is because of rain, and they didn't, it was just sloppy and they weren't going to handle the slop. And so they scratched the horse. And I was like, this horse is going to run lights out at Parks on, because then they kind of identified the next biggest day that they could go and kind of get some attention. And so they went to Parks for Pennsylvania Derby Day, and the horse ran lights out, won by like six lengths. Over a next out winner, and actually ended up going and winning a listed stakes race in the second time out. So, you know, those are just those instances where the trainer intent, you know, if you hear somebody's trying to run at Saratoga, it's like, they clearly think a lot of this horse, like that's, right. you know, that's a prestigious meet to get up to. And, you know, similarly, if a trainer is kind of slow playing a horse and it's like, we'll see. We'll debut him at like Gulfstream during the non-championship meet. Like if a Todd Pletcher horse is doing that, it's like, okay, like that's an okay horse in Pletcher's barn then probably, or one that maybe yeah. needs a race or two under their belt before they really take off.
And even it even ties back into your tip one of understanding track hierarchies, because there are certain places that are high up on that track hierarchy where people want their two-year-olds to win on debut.
Yeah.
Those places are Keeneland, Del Mar, Saratoga.
Yup.
What's the reason for that? It's because these are meccas of horse auctions and the thoroughbred breeding industry. It's about their pride, these different breeders saying, hey, I'm able to breed this many first out winners at the Keeneland Spring Meet. I'm able to breed this many first out winners, Saratoga winners at Saratoga. It's really important how much people's, you know, own pride and vanity of, you know, plays into it as a just a business thing for that. So, yeah, knowing that this person's only going to put their best horses in at Keeneland for, and also paying attention to the connections and saying, you know, I know that Steve Aspison has a Winchell Thoroughbreds horse that he's running at Keeneland for the very first time. Well, Winchell only gives him his best, their best, you know, best horses. He's only going to try to win at Keeneland with Winchell, you know, as an owner, you know, for the breeders and everything. For the love of God, it's called the Breeders' Cup. It's not because, you know, it's not just a derogatory term for straight bars. It is meant to do with the old horse jizz biz. So My number one tip. This is the thing that falls by the wayside, usually first, when people are trying to handicap. They haven't given themselves enough time, and it's just like, I would like to do this, but I just, you know, I couldn't do it. I didn't have time. It's not something that I really wanted, you know, could swing. So I just went by the paper. Watch replays. For the love of God, watch replays. And there are three, this is three-pronged with watching replays. First is, comment lines are small in a past performance. You go to a results chart. It's only a couple, you've gone from a few words to a couple sentences that doesn't really necessarily tell the test, you know, tell what happened during a race. Nothing tells you what happened in a race, what kind of trip a horse got, more than just going and watching the horse's replay of its race. Say the horse ran an impressive race, go and see if it was really that impressive. Did the horse have everything his own way? We don't know. Horse ran a really shitty race. Sometimes things happen and it's like, they just will, you know, they only have like six words to tell you what happened in a race in a past performance. And so they might not tell you that the horse, you know, jumped over a shadow, or the horse, mm-hmm. you know, the rider lost the whip, things like that. You can really go back and start either upgrading or downgrading horses based on how they looked. But this is the second prong, and it ties directly back into this. If you're going to watch a horse's, replay and try to gauge what kind of trip it got, how it ran, especially if it's a track that you don't know, you don't understand the bias, it's not going to help you to view that race in a vacuum on its own. At least go through and just kind of speed through races during the day and get an idea of what the track bias might have been. Mm-hmm. And then you can start once again upgrading and downgrading, because you'll know, hey, this horse ran lights out. It had a great trip. Maybe showed a little bit, but at the end of the day, it caught the rail. And the rail was hot, and the rail was just carrying winners. That's what I saw with a bunch of, you don't always just go by the post position too. Like, you need to go back and look at paths, which that's a whole other talk. Like, we'll do a show on track bias sometime, and that's a whole other talk that's involved. And then day of, like, watching replays. So you've handicapped your card, you've watched your replays for past performances, you watch replays to see if they were running, you know, with or against a bias. That's great. That's all the prep work. But when you're in the trenches sometimes and you're actually going through a day's card, you have to be agile, mobile, and fucking hostile. Because, I mean, at the end of the day, it's pari-mutuel wagering, and it's every man for himself. Sorry. I'll just cut it off. My eyes lit up when I realized I could work that in one more time. Watch actual replays from the track feed right after the race runs. There's a reason that they show these. Not, they don't just give you snippets. It's not like watching SportsCenter and seeing, you know, Bam Adebayo, you know, dunk on somebody. It's like you get to see how Bam Adebayo got into place to dunk on people. Like, you get to watch the entire race, and they don't only give it to you from the pan, they give you another angle. They give you the head on. The head on is so fucking important. It's so important for understanding how a track is playing, why even a track is necessarily playing that way, what paths winners are taking, what sort of moves winners are taking, where horses who made up ground late, what kind of trip did they get? Horses who faded late, what kind of trip did they get? And also, I mean, even if you're not able to, I know some of y'all have day jobs, or you're getting your bets in and kind of you're watching under the table while someone is saying something really important to you. You're just like, yeah, believe me, probably wouldn't be doing this for a living if that weren't the case. So, you know, go back after the day is complete, especially if you're way off, and start watching those head-on replays and start figuring out what the fuck was going on that you were missing, that you just weren't seeing. And you can really kind of right the ship really quick. Really quick, you can right the ship as soon as you figure out how that track is playing. Now, is it foolproof? No, but what in horse racing is? I mean, you get Jim Bob with a fucking handful of mushrooms and a bottle of whiskey. He might go out there and just fuck that track up on his night off, you know? Might just be like Crash Davis trying to get a rain out in the Carolina League.
It is... It, yeah, Now, I could not agree more. And you know, when I saw you were going to talk about race replays, I'm glad, because that was going to be one of my angles as well. I love watching race replays, and I love watching. And here's the thing is, when I'm really handicapping a card, I'll watch race replays a couple of times just to kind of look at the, especially if there's multiple horses in the same race that are now racing again. A lot of times you'll see this with like Derby prep races or sometimes Breeders' Cup races, where there's three or four horses that have run against each other in a previous race. I love watching that. And I'll watch three or four times to track every single horse, because your eye can only catch so much. And so I want to see what happened to each of those horses in that particular race and look at their, and look at it. And then you mentioned the head on versus the more panoramic wide angle view. And here's the other thing, and you're absolutely right. And there's a reason that my handle on Twitter has failed to menace, because it's the funniest racing line, in my opinion, because it means nothing. It just like, if you show somebody who just started handicapping failed to menace, they'd be like, what the hell does that mean? And like, you gotta watch the race a couple times to kind of understand what that note actually means. But it's also something where, you said it, they have six words to kind of get everything smashed in there. One of the things I always look at in race replays, horses that get stuck on the rail that are full of run.
Yeah.
And that happens so much. I hate seeing a horse second flight inside position. It's the worst, because the horse in front inevitably fades and backs up into the horse that I was liking. And then next thing you know, that horse is full of run but can't get out in the clear. And so you can, again, that's what you don't always see sometimes with those comments. And you watch a replay and you realize, oh, that horse is loaded for bear. And if this horse gets even anywhere near a decent trip this next time out, it's going to be ready to roll. So I love watching replays, fully endorse that, and do it at all different levels too. Like, that's the thing, is replays, you know, some of these angles I was talking about are better at lower levels than upper level. Race replays are great any level, anyway, any track, across the board. You're going to learn something.
And I mean, if you're able to learn how to manage your time in terms of how you're handicapped, especially if you're doing it every day. Like for me, I'm handicapping pretty much every day. And it's either for my tip sheets, it's for my own personal play, it's for, you know, all sorts of stuff. I've got to budget my time out. And so learn to budget your time with how you're, when you have time to handicapping, and make sure that you're budgeting out that time to go back through and say, can I look at this replay? Now, watching a replay of every single horse, you probably should do it. That's a lot of time, though.
A lot of time.
So at least be going back and looking at, you know, horses where they have inexplicably low figures or inexplicably high figures, and figure out just what the hell, just what the hell happened. And I mean, you will understand the importance of replays just to a T the first time you watch a head-on break from a gate and see absolutely everything that happens when they're colliding off of each other. That's stuff that doesn't even get mentioned. You know, if you see the words pinballed start, that horse had a really fucking bad start.
Right.
And it's probably not even going to say anything about the other horses that this one pinballed off of.
Right.
Like, it's not even going to mention that. That's not even going to come into there. And so you can say, well, this one pinballed around and knocked mine into the 3X score multiplier and all that bullshit. So, no, yeah.
It's true. I mean, again, a lot of times, what I would say is, you can't watch all the replays, obviously, but I would say horses that you're intrigued in, that might be a big value, look for those. Again, and then sometimes you can catch something in the note where it's like, it hints at trouble and you're like, I need to dig in. Like, how bad of trouble was this? Was this just like getting kind of pushed out one path, or was this like egregious? And so again, you don't pick that up. So sometimes you're just reading through the form and you just kind of pick up a note and you're like, I want to take a closer look at this just to see exactly what they mean by it. So we all have day jobs. And so we all gotta, we gotta figure that stuff out.
You know, in my case, I'll say I kind of got a day job. Matthew's got a day job. Man, so in your absence, Cyril Bodway, she's made up a bunch of ground. I need to go back and calculate the scores and see where you are, because you're still the king, you know. But
when you're the king, everybody comes shooting for you, and you know, it is and Sarah's a good friend. Yeah, Sarah's a good friend. I've done a lot of stuff with Sarah. Sarah actually met my dad over the Thanksgiving holiday during one of our we did a preview of a race, and my dad decided to chime in with his thoughts. And he actually
picked
one of the winners, believe it or not. So, but Sarah, if Sarah overtakes me, so be it. Anybody else, I might have words, but we'll that's for another day.
I sent Sarah a message on Thanksgiving because I watched that video that you guys made, and it was like, you know, it was on your show, which, by the way, go ahead, give him the title. Matthew's doing his show again, and it's important that you check it out. Matthew, title of the show.
It's called The Win Place Show, and you can find it on my Twitter feed at Failed to Menace.
Yeah, and so I'm watching that video that you did, and she threw in an edit back to the very first time that you guys were on screen together. And that was touching, moving stuff. Like, I'm watching it on Thanksgiving, the time to be around family and friends to really be thankful for them. And then you see this nostalgic flashback to the very first time that Matthew met Sarah, and I tugged on the heartstrings. Like, why are you crying on the couch? Like, you wouldn't understand.
It's funny. That's the reason we did the preview, because the very first time she ever did anything on video, I had invited her on the show last year, November of 2021, to preview the Cumley Stakes. And so she thought it would be only appropriate to preview the Cumley Stakes for 2022 together. So it was really nice to do that. But I also just cry on the couch sometimes around the holidays for no reason at all. So there's that as well. But
seasonal affective disorder is a thing. it's real. Don't let anyone tell you that.
No, it is. It's very real.
That's good stuff. That's good stuff. I'm glad to see that y'all got to do stuff together. And it's funny. It's like now, you know, it's like we're the Ike Turners and she's the Tina. Like, she's the
abuse.
Yeah, without much less abuse. For one, I think that Sarah could beat me up. Two, it's just don't do it. I guess would be the main takeaway. Probably don't do that.
Don't do that. But yeah, she is. She's a star, and but it's great. I mean, I think that's, you know, the beauty of tying this back to, you know, what we were talking about here earlier is the beauty is when you talk to different people, they all have different perspectives and angles on this sort of thing. And they're all worth thinking about because they've clearly worked for these different people. And it's about how they leverage that information. So when you're new to horse racing, if you're just getting really serious about horse racing, don't shut yourself off from other ideas, and don't get so set in your ways that you don't learn from other people. Is the best thing I can tell people. And I can't tell you how much I've learned from you, from Sarah, from other people across horse racing Twitter about different tracks, different angles, the whole nine yards.
It's not like we grew up in the 1920s selling papes in Brooklyn, and then we get off work at 10 o'clock for the day. Don't go to school. We go straight to the track. And then there's some, you know, Obi-Wan Kenobi style wise guy who will teach you all about handicapping anymore. Like, that, those days are past. Like, yes. I'll tell you what, I learned handicapping by talking to strange men on the internet. So I encourage you, do that a lot, but seriously, like, go to the horse racing Reddit, join a Discord, do things like talk to people on Twitter. Hell, shoot people DMs, ask them things. Yeah. A lot of the times, if they don't have something that they're trying to sell, then they'll more than likely love chopping it up with you and try to teach you something, because, you know, one, it's important for our existence to, you know, continue. But two, you might make a friend. Who knows?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Look at us.
Look at us. Just a fucking success story of when talking to strange men on the internet goes right. hell, he and I got a random email from this Nigerian Mr. Adebayo, who was like, hey, listen, one of your relatives died. You're entitled to all this money. Just send us the money. We did it. The money came back 100-fold, just like you promised. I don't know why people are so wary of them. That's going to do it for us here at the Notorious OTB. Listen to this one. Listen to these tips. Fold them into what you're doing if it's not something that you're doing already. And also, if it's something that we need to know, at the show on Twitter, at Notorious_OTB, give us a, you know, throw some suggestions. We'd love to hear them. I'll read them off here on the show so that everyone can enjoy them. And, you know, check it out. Give the show a follow. Like it. Rate it. Review it on Spotify, wherever you get it. And, yeah, we'll see you, I guess, Wednesday. I think I got Dennis Trusty coming in on nice. To do our Wednesday show. The world's oldest young man on horse racing Twitter.
Great. He's like, statement.
He says he's 24. That man, he is
47 years old. And
yeah.
May have already had at least one organ replaced, I'm thinking of at this point.
The only thing he's ever done to clue me in to make me think that he might actually be the age that he says he is was it was right around the time he would have turned 21, if he is indeed of this age. He was like, oh, I need something better to drink. Like, I'm drinking Jose Cuervo and I'm chasing it with cherry Pepsi. I'm like, what? Who are you? Why are you like this? No, man. No.
He's such a good guy, though, and he can always take a joke. So I like Dennis a lot.
Me too. I love that dude. We'll see him later this week. We got other people coming on. Matthew, of course, he'll be around. Now that I got him nailed down, he'll be back in sometime soon, I'm sure. So we'll catch you next time on the Notorious OTB, brought to you by the Sports Gambling Podcast Network. We'll see you later this week.